From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
And thanks very much, Ollie Barrett. It's another wet and windy, well, not so windy, a bit wet anyway, in Salford and Greater Manchester. This is your Richie Allen Show, the first one of the week. Monday it is. It's just after 5 p.m. UK time here in the great city of Greater Manchester, but the even greater city of Salford. Welcome to the programme. I've got a brilliant guest for you. And before that, I think I've got an excellent news roundup too. Lots to talk about, as always.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And who's going to Old Trafford this coming Saturday for the Super League Grand Final? Is it Dirty Leeds? No, it's not Dirty Leeds. Is it Wanky Warrington? No, it isn't Wanky Warrington. Salford Red Devils? Marvellous. Tickets have been accrued. The Tesman has organised the tickets live at Old Trafford will be this coming Saturday. Can't wait for that. Anyway, welcome to the programme. Enough of the sport, enough of the sport. Let's tell you about the guest this evening. I'll be joined by Dr. Robin Kelly live in New Zealand. In fact, it'll be Tuesday morning in New Zealand. Fair play to Robin for coming on the programme so early. He is a doctor and author, and he has integrated into his medical practice for many years Eastern medicine, Western medicine, modern mind-body concepts as well. He's written some terrifically well-received books about the human hologram and other things. We're going to talk about many things with Dr. Robin. We'll talk about old-school medicine and old-school doctors versus modern medicine and modern doctors. We'll talk vaccines, we'll talk 5G and much more with him in an extended conversation a little bit later on in the program. How does that sound to you? And as always, you can join in by tweeting me. My Twitter handle is at Richie Allen Show. Europe's most listened to independent radio show, live right now on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Multiple platforms and richieallen.co.uk as well. Dun-dun-dun, there you are. Lovely. Lovely, I says. And if I say it's lovely, it's got to be lovely. Now, let's jump straight in. You have the details. Because I like to be a bit unconventional, I'm not going to start off with Extinction Rebellion. No, I'm not. I like to be a bit unconventional, and I did cover that extensively in the newspaper roundup this morning on YouTube, which has got nothing to do with this programme. But anyway, we'll talk about Extinction Rebellion in a few moments. Before that, though, we'll also talk about Boris Johnson's relationship with Jennifer Arcuri, the businesswoman. We'll talk about that, too. But before that, we'll talk about mental health and we will talk about extreme hate groups. Two different issues, extreme hate groups in a minute, in a mo. Before that, though, mental health. Because Britain's Got Talent was taken over the final on Saturday, allegedly. I talked about this on Sunday View, when the programme stopped for a minute so that the presenters could encourage people at home to think a little bit about their mental health. Yeah. Yeah, I know, I've been on this one for years, haven't I? Now, the Dukes and Duchesses of Sussex and Cambridge, that'd be William, Harry and the two women they are married to. They've come together to make a television ad, a new telly ad, for a new mental health campaign. They got sod all to do, these privileged royals, so they've taken it upon themselves to convince everybody in the country that they've got mental health problems. So they've made a short film and it's going to be broadcast tonight on multiple television channels at 9:15. I can hardly wait. Can't wait for this programme to finish now so I can see the ad. It's a 3-minute film which features Meghan and Harry, but also the actress Glenn Close, the Bunny Boiler from Fatal Attraction, Freddie Flintoff, the pissed up cricketer, Davina McCall, the ex-junkie, who used to host Big Brother, and others. And it's been introduced by Claire Balding. And it's going to go out at 8:45 p.m. on Sky. It's going to go out on Channel 4, ITV, Channel 5 and MTV all at the same time. Because we've all got mental health problems. You have to accept it, whether you like it or not. It's called Every Mind Matters. It's an initiative to provide a free online plan, listen carefully now, free online plan to help those in need to learn to cope with stress, boost their mood, sleep better, and feel in control. It's a free online plan. It gives you a health quiz, which when you take it, provides you with a personalized mind plan that can help you learn how to look after your own mental health. Do you want to hear a fragment of the advertisement which will premiere at 8:45 p.m. tonight with Harry and Meghan and junkies and boozed up cricketers telling you that you've got mental health issues? Here's a little bit of the ad on the Richie. It's an exclusive. It isn't. They've been running some of this ad all day long. Here it is.
We feel stressed.
By the way, not do you feel stressed or are you stressed? You feel stressed. Because the importance is that we all accept that we've got mental health.
We feel stressed, low, anxious, or have trouble sleeping.
Well, I fucking do now, Harry.
We think there's nothing to be done. Nothing we can do about it.
But now, there's a new way to help turn things around. Every Mind Matters will show you simple ways to look after your mental health.
It'll get you started with a free online plan designed to help you deal with stress.
There you are. What else would you do when you're feeling a bit low? Then go to a non-governmental organization's website and fill in a questionnaire, eh? What could possibly go wrong, I tell you, eh?
What kind of fuckery is this?
You feel unwell, don't you? You feel stressed. You're finding it difficult to sleep. Well, here's the Every Mind Matters app. Come online, join us, and tell us all about yourself. Free online plan. All that data designed to help you deal with stress. Have a listen to this. Kadra Abdinasir works at the Centre for Mental Health. Why does that sound so spooky? The Centre for Mental Health. Her name is Kadra Abdinasir, and she was on Sky News. I think you will hear Isabel Webster, the presenter, first. Then you'll hear the mental health woman. This is good.
So in this advert, it's directing people, isn't it, to go to this website, Every Mind Matters, and there are some simple questions that people can answer. And then it's not about sending them off to particular clinics or expensive resources. Very simple suggestions and tips on how to manage their mental health. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So the resources created to help people with emerging mental health problems and issues that all of us face. So things like anxiety, stress and sleep problems. And they give you really tangible, quick solutions for you to implement and to share with your friends and family.
So Kadra, I was doing a bit of research and I read that...
Wait for this. The presenter was doing a bit of research. That's a Pinocchio-esque lie, by the way. Presenters don't do anything. Unless you're me, because I don't have four producers, three editors, and a head of programs. It's just me. So she didn't do any research. Her producer told her this startling fact. You're not going to believe your ears. You might want to syringe your ears when you hear this.
That 80% of the population have shown signs of poor mental health within the last year.
No, what? What? What?
Family.
So, Kadra, I was doing a bit of research and I read that 80% of the population have shown signs of poor mental health within the last year. And that is an absolutely staggering figure.
Give over. Really?
And clearly something of an epidemic.
There's an epidemic of mental health problems in the country. Now I'm beginning to understand the term gaslighting and what it means in a wider context, in the context of the population. We're being told constantly that we are mentally weak, that we've got mental health problems, and we are constantly being told that we need to accept that we do have them and that we must talk about them, that it isn't taboo anymore. And now she's pulled this figure out of her arse. 80% of the people have shown signs of mental health, she said, just in case you think I'm lying.
Within the last year, that is an absolutely staggering...
Your friends and family.
So, Kadra, I was doing a bit of research and I read that 80% of the population have shown signs of poor mental health within the last year. And that is an absolutely staggering figure and clearly something of an epidemic.
An epidemic, right.
Epidemic.
Yes, so that is based on the survey that was conducted as part of this campaign that launched today. And I think it's important to recognise that these are daily challenges that all of us can face. But the problem is when they escalate and become too overwhelming, that they can lead to some more serious mental health problems down the line.
This is bullshit. Wait till you hear what the presenter says next, Isabel Webster, because it gives it away. I've been telling you for years on this programme, I've constantly... played clips of television and radio programs talking about mental health. You know, I've done this a lot. I've reminded this audience that how strange it is that the national media keeps talking about mental health never ending. Listen to this admission from the presenter.
How big is the taboo, do you think, still? I mean, it's an issue we talk about almost daily, if not weekly here.
Yeah, that's the truth. And thanks so much for telling the truth.
I mean, it's an issue we talk about almost daily, if not weekly here.
And why would they? Sky News purports to be an organisation that provides its audience with news bulletins to update them on the goings-on in the country and internationally. Why would Sky News be talking about mental health daily and weekly? And why would BBC be doing it as well? Because there is an agenda... to convince the populace that they are unwell and that they need help and that they need to be telling healthcare professionals and others what they are thinking all the time about anything. Why do you think that is? Who's got the most to gain by the population going online and filling out surveys about how they feel at any given time? Do you see where I'm going with this? You see... been banging on about this now for about 5 years, going back to my time in London. I was mesmerised when I was watching local London television, I think it was ITV London or something, and their local news bulletin was talking about mental health. I'd been watching it earlier that day on the BBC, and it had occurred to me that other stations were doing the same thing, and it hasn't relented in 5 years, 6 years. Hasn't relented. Mental health, mental health, mental health. Why do you think? It isn't as simplistic as the pharmaceutical corporations of the world want to get everybody on certain medication. That is a part of it, but a tiny part of it. There is a surveillance part of it, and ultimately there is a mind control aspect or part to it as well. This is crazy stuff, people, you know? I suppose, there you are. The nation's children going online to an app when they feel tired or when they feel fed up or when they can't sleep. The irony being, of course, their sleep is being interrupted by the very devices that host or download the apps in the first place. You could choke on the irony. Wi-Fi. Yeah. This is the Richie Allen Show. It's 16 and a half minutes past the hour. So much to get through. And Sara Khan is a counter-extremism commissioner. She's the counter-extremism commissioner, Sara Khan. And she has published a report today called Challenging Hateful Extremism. And because of the distraction of Extinction Rebellion, because of the distraction of Boris Johnson's sexual fumblings, allegedly, and because of the Brexit distraction, one of the biggest stories in the world today has gone unnoticed, or at least the UK's broadcast media has pretty much not covered it. 18 months of evidence has been gathered, and the Counter-Extremism Commissioner has published a brand new report called Challenging Hateful Extremism. And in it, she has identified a new category of harmful extremist activity. She has coined a phrase in this new report, a phrase called hateful extremism. And it is something that must be dealt with, and it must be dealt with at the speed of light. And in the Telegraph today, she wrote, she wrote an opinion piece supporting the publication of her report, which took nearly 2 years. And she says, "Today, after 18 months of evidence gathering, my commission is releasing a report called Challenging Hateful Extremism, which has identified a new category called hateful extremism. Hateful extremism is described as behaviours that incite and amplify hate or engage in persistent hatred or make the moral case for violence," she says. "Drawing on hateful, hostile or supremacist beliefs, our report shows how it is causing harm to individuals, communities and wider society." What she is saying there in plain English is people's ideas and their views of the world are causing people harm, therefore we need to put the stop to it. She goes on to talk about hateful extremism on the right and on the left, and Islamist extremism and animal rights extremism and all of that. She talks about visiting 20 towns and cities, receiving 3,000 responses to a call for evidence, meeting with 30 academics, and all of that is the basis of this brand new report on hateful extremism. Okay? "Hateful extremists spread anti-minority disinformation and conspiracy theories, including online, amassing hundreds of thousands of views to normalize hate and recruit others to their cause. The consequence was social division and attacks on Asians." She's referring to a survey they did in Sunderland, where a far-right group organised 13 marches in 13 months. She said the far-right group spread anti-minority disinformation conspiracy theories, and they got lots of views, and they normalised hate. But you see, hate can't be criminalised. Because surely people are entitled to hate, even if they're wrong. Why would you hate, right? But we do live amongst people who do hate other groups of people. There aren't many. But that is their right, isn't it? So long as they are not committing acts of violence or urging others to commit acts of violence, you can't legislate for hate, surely. Well, apparently you can. She talks about the anti-LGBT protests in Birmingham, right? Which in fact was parents coming together to say they didn't want their children to be exposed to sexual education at such a young age. But this could be hateful, you see. She says, "We need to distinguish between democratic debate and hateful extremist activity. We must continue to protect and preserve freedom of expression," she says. But that is a direct contradiction to what she said previously. They won't preserve freedom of expression. She says we have to include the preservation of our rights to be radical, to protest and even to be offensive. She says we need more free speech and more debate. Sounds very good, but she's lying. She says today she's calling on the government to urgently overhaul its approach to focus on hateful extremism. Extremism motivated by hate, which is going online, talking about things with others who share the same point of view that you do. You might blame the Muslims for everything, right? And there are people who blame the Muslims for everything. And they might go on Facebook and they might have a little chinwag on their private groups on Facebook about how they're bloody Muslims, right? Right? They're not doing any harm. They're not speaking to Muslims. They're not approaching them. And they're not doing anything to them. And they're not urging others to do anything either. So I would say they're a bunch of morons, Ted. But leave them alone, right? No. This is hateful. They have to be dealt with. She says social media companies must do more, of course, to reduce the hostile atmosphere. Public bodies need to do more to protect victims of hate. Victims. You should see the emails I get when I talk about certain things. The vitriol, the bile in some of the emails. I don't feel threatened. Somebody letting off a bit of steam, right? She says, "Challenging hateful extremism is about upholding our plural and democratic way of life, about defending our diverse country, which is made up of different races, political opinions, sexualities, religions and beliefs," she concludes. My question would be, although Sarah Khan is never going to come on this programme, And I think it's the right question. Who or what gets to distinguish what exactly hateful extremism is? Who gets to distinguish what vitriol, anger? Who gets to distinguish between vitriolic posting, anger, bewilderment, and hateful extremism? Who gets to make the decision? Is it a government czar? A hateful extremism czar? A judge? Would it be left up to the government of the day, maybe? Like, who gets to read through thousands of Facebook pages, for example, that might discuss alternative theories on things like false flag terrorism, migration, banking, health, the Middle East, Israel, Zionism? Who gets to sift through all of that and decide what is hateful extremism? At what point do you say, well, that's hateful, that's extremist? Who gets to make that decision? Surely you couldn't possibly do that without first making a definitive ruling on whether something is truthful or not truthful. You get me? That's the crux of it, right? You would become the arbiter directly as to what is true and what isn't true. For example, as the government czar, you might be trolling people's discussions looking for hate, and people are talking about how harmful it is to talk to children about their sexuality, to get them thinking about being born in the wrong body or about 100 genders. You might say, wow. You might say some of that might harm children, or it might harm LGBT or trans men or trans women. So will the Tsar, or eventually the AI program, delete that and ban the user because it might be offensive or deemed hateful? Or will the arbiter of hateful extremism first determine whether there is any validity in what has been posted? Because there is validity in that one instance. The parent's argument is valid. Let's not talk about sex to 5-year-old children. Any type of sex. Just leave them be, right? But that could be interpreted as hate towards the trans people. And someone or something is going to become the arbiter of what is okay to say and what isn't okay to say. It's one of the biggest stories in the news today anywhere, and it is getting no coverage. A brand new report published by the extremism, Jesus Christ, the counter-extremism commissioner. She has invented a new category of extremism called hateful extremism. It's got to be dealt with. Hateful extremism doesn't have any tangible victims. Of course it doesn't. That doesn't matter. It's got to be dealt with. 26 minutes it is past the hour. I know there are lots and lots of tweets, and I swear to God and sunny Jesus that I will read them in a second, but I've got to move on. There's so much to talk about this hour. So to Extinction Rebellion, then, the sweaty, scruffy, grimy, middle-class wasters who think we're all going to die in 12 years. Or 10, by the way. They can't seem to make their minds up, can they? Is it 12? Is it 10? A few hundred arrested today. Not enough of them, though. They're a bit like Agent Smith from The Matrix, aren't they? Every time you arrest one of the hemp-wearing goons, another head of dirty dreadlocks comes running around the bloody corner, right? Every time you arrest one of them, chuck him into a van, you see dreadlocks running at you in the distance, the bastards. They're everywhere. Extinction Rebellion. Extinction Rebellion. We're all going to die. We're all going to die. So they've started 2 weeks of protest in London today, but also Berlin, Amsterdam and Sydney. Because nobody's listening, so they need to block up streets and basically cause a bit of a nuisance. They want to shut down key sites in London. They want to demonstrate outside government departments. They say that the protests in London will be 5 times bigger than the protests back in April. They want urgent action on global climate and wildlife emergencies. Do you want me to give you the specifics? What did they specifically want? They want the government to declare a climate emergency. They want the UK to legally commit to reducing carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. They want a citizens' assembly to oversee the changes. That's what they want. I was telling my Uncle Junior what they wanted.
I want to fuck Angie Dickinson. See who gets lucky first.
Yeah, I would have said Diana Rigg, Lucy Liu Jr., to be honest. Anyway, do you want to hear some of these people? Here they are, the soap shy wasters themselves.
Well, I've come here as part of Extinction Rebellion, but also Stop Ecocide, Change the Law. I'm part of that campaign team. And, you know, we're in a mass extinction here. We've got an emergency, and I am beyond distraught that my children and my grandchildren won't die of old age. You know, and I am no longer willing to just sit. I was never willing to sit back, actually. But, you know, this is an emergency. And, you know, the more we can get behind this and, you know, get this on the political agenda, you know, we need to make great changes and we need to make them right now. And, you know, changing the law, getting ecocide recognised as, you know, a criminal law at the United Nations, you know, that is one of the most important things that we have to do right now.
What would you say to those ordinary people who are not part of this protest who will come along Millbank and say, they blocked Lambeth Bridge, I'm going to be late for work, it's going to be hard to pick my kids up, this is just one thing too many?
Well, you know, I get that, and there's going to be really frustrated people, and, you know, I'm personally really sorry for that, of course. It's going to annoy a lot of people. But also, we're not here to make friends. We are here to really bring about this change. And like I said, it has to happen very quickly. We just don't have the time. And I know it's going to upset a lot of people. And it's going to be nothing compared to what is coming if we do not act.
Yeah, this is the sloganeering that we've often talked about, you and me. The sloganeering. You know, nothing compared to what's coming and all of that. But it's empty rhetoric. There isn't any supporting evidence, at least, well, there isn't, of course, full stop, so these women and these people, they don't have any evidence either. But they're having the time of their lives in London, and they're unlikely to be asked any real questions by the presenters or the reporters on scene. This made me laugh, though. A woman describing herself as a privileged woman.
Just what I was talking about a minute ago, about these plastic pipes, that's what they have. There's three protesters are linked by two plastic pipes there, their arms inside there and chained up. So just to make it that bit more difficult for the police. Let's just see if we can have a quick word. Excuse me, you're live on Sky News. Hiya. Can you tell us how long are you hoping to stay here?
In general, we're hoping to be here for 2 weeks or as long as it takes.
I mean, it's been raining off and on, you don't mind that. Clearly the police will probably get to you in an hour or so, but you are happy to be arrested for your cause?
I'm here to be arrested, yeah.
She's here to be arrested?
Yeah.
How important do you think it is to be here?
I think currently this is the most important thing happening globally, but, I mean, especially somewhere like the UK, where, I mean, I'm quite a privileged person, so I don't really have a lot of other things to be striving for at the moment.
I'm a privileged person and I don't have a lot of other things to be striving for. Go and judge a bakery competition somewhere. Jesus wept, huh? Yeah. A little bit more of this, because there were some interesting debates on Sky this morning. The journalist Yasmin Alibi Brown, I used to interview her years ago and I used to refer to her as Yasmin Alibi Brown, and she never corrected me, but apparently it's Yasmin Alibi Brown. She's a big fan of Extinction Rebellion. As the journalist Ella Whelan isn't, both of them were talking to Sky News' Adam Bolton earlier today, and there were some interesting points made in the discussion.
All movements which are trying to kind of, you know, come at a cause which has really, which needs that kind of shake-up, have this history. Anti-racists have always had this history, so I do not agree with her.
I'm not sure about this. I don't recall anti-racist protests as pro-Mandela protests shutting down London and stopping people for 2 weeks.
Not for 2 weeks, but we did on several Saturdays.
Well, marches are one thing. Every Saturday. This is about the working week.
I am with them. I think we are in crisis.
Clever is slightly cruel in that but also perceptive in that she kind of takes the mick about them all being in tie-dye shirts and with dreadlocks. Yes. And there's that stereotype, and that's kind of a silly point. I think the more serious point is that, in contrast to movements that went before, grassroots movements like the anti-racist movement, it's very good that you brought up suffragettes, because I think they're actually very different to them, because what Extinction Rebellion, well, it's politics at the heart of it, is saying is that we won't listen to anyone. We will not. We are not up for compromise, or not even compromise, but we're not up for a kind of democratic approach to this. What we want is you either listen to the science or you get kind of railroaded by us.
You listen to their interpretation of the science.
Exactly, exactly.
It is science. It is science. You can't have interpretation of science.
I think part of the problem is that, and this is what Clefage is talking about, is that she says they need to win over Middle England, and she compares them to kind of extreme left-wing movements. Well, the difference between Extinction Rebellion and left-wing movements, or movements like it that were arguing for more social justice, more democracy, progressive things like this, is that they really are at the heart of Extinction Rebellion's movement is a hatred of ordinary people. And this is what gets me most about them, and why absolutely I'm not with them, though I have a care for the environment.
That's very good from Ella Whelan there. She categorised Extinction Rebellion very well there. There are a bunch of people who scream at people, telling them this is the way it is, and you must do what we tell you, and if you don't, we'll walk all over you. You don't exist. You're a non-human. And she says they basically hate people, which they do. Now, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. They can hate whoever they want. That's their prerogative. They can do that if they want. But this is it. There's nothing sane or rational about them. I understand Brendan O'Neill wrote an excellent piece in Spiked Online about them. I had it sent to me by Jean Ann. Earlier on, I did read a few bits of it. Yeah, it's good. Nothing new, but it's good. It's very well written. It is an extremist movement. It's an it's almost taken on evangelical overtones, I would say. It's becoming more and more hysterical. Those connected to it are becoming more and more self-righteous and convinced that they really are in the middle of this kind of battle between good and evil, and they're so very good, and the people who won't listen and who just go about their daily business are evil. And this is the thinking that leads to ideas like, you know, Georgia Guidestones, like we need to cull the planet of 4.5 million or billion people, you know, or 5 billion people. Anyway, Ella Whelan was doing well there, but she was getting on the breasts, I can't say the T word, of Yasmin Alibi Brown.
The Rebellion's movement is a hatred of ordinary
people. A hatred of ordinary people.
Of ordinary people. And this is what gets me most about them, and why absolutely I'm not with them, though I have a care for the environment.
You should have heard these old ladies this morning on the radio. They were ordinary people. They were ordinary people.
Yeah, I heard that interview on the Today programme, yeah. And it's true that it's not like, I think the stereotype of them all being kind of, you know, posh and out there to have a good time is also silly. But the important thing...
They're deranged.
...is that the things that they're arguing for, like cutting carbon emissions to whatever data it is they pick this week, means disenfranchising lots of people, ruining lots of people's working lives in terms of, you know, from my own personal experience, meaning you have to give up your car that you might use for work and all these kinds of things. It's not a democratic approach to politics. And I fear that, especially in relation to water ceremonies and spraying fake blood all over the place, it's starting to feel a bit cultish, and I don't think that's a good route for anyone involved in politics.
Good stuff. It's getting a bit cultish. Well, it's beyond cultish now, I think, at this stage. Adam Bolton wants to challenge the notion that it's a global movement.
Environmentalism is a global movement, but I mean, the tactics of extension,
they're global. Young people are extremely worried about their future. Are we just going to dismiss them with this really quite sinister, unfair piece that Claire Foger, she's made
What's
no attempt.
About it? What's
there's
unfair?
Only one, there's only one well, bit. That is, I think, she's trying...
They're talking about an article in the Mail where a journalist has been scathingly critical of I don't think she used the term evangelical, but the almost religious fervour of the protesters and their ridiculous demands and their hostility towards people. So they're actually talking about an article that you won't have read or you might not have read.
To attend to their cause... Only one small paragraph. Otherwise, they're this.
No, wait a minute. She says we're irritated by the diversion of police resources away from terrorism and knife crime. Well, we've already seen 14 policemen dealing with one car. We despair at their hopelessly unrealistic demands of net zero carbon emissions by 2025. Well, that is not even in the United Nations climate change targets. She says, and it would require a hit to our economy, public services and lifestyles that few would agree a good idea. We're frustrated, by the way, that they direct their rage at the
and
UK.
And who is this we?
This is Claire Foges. When, relatively, we are doing rather well on the low-carbon front. Emissions here have fallen by 42%, faster than any other G7 nation. And we know clenching frustrations their tactics can inflict. Now, a lot of people, that will resonate with a lot of people, won't
yes,
it?
Yes, it resonates with me because exactly like...
So it's not a terrible article.
No, it is a terrible article because it's only one-sided.
What was that? Oh, the irony was so thick there you could choke on it. It's only one-sided, said Yasmin Alibi Brown. If you read The Guardian lately, love. Or The Independent, love. Two newspapers who won't tolerate dissent, who will not interview or feature people who are challenging this monumental bollocks, because it is monumental bollocks that if we don't cut carbon to net zero by 6 years from now, that we're going to be all dead in 12 years. It is fucking patently bollocks. Of course it's bollocks. Well, it's all one-sided in this particular article, said Brown. What a foolish thing to say anyway. It was an opinion piece. Opinion pieces are subjective by design, right? Ah, mad times. Mad times. It's coming up for 22. There was one last bit of frivolity, though. Animal Rebellion is in London as well today, and they don't want to be outshone by Extinction Rebellion. So Animal Rebellion was there. One woman... She's like the Judean People's Front, so she is. Whatever happened to the Judeans? That's them over there. Splitters. Her name is Kay Lavelle. She's heading Animal Rebellion, and she wanted to get her say in London today too.
Kay Lavelle, who will probably be able to tell me a bit more about Animal Rebellion. Tell us why you're here today.
So we're here to demand a complete system change. So to actually transition into a plant-based food system, because as we now know, animal agriculture accounts for a huge, huge amount, and it causes really devastating impact on the environment.
Agriculture is destroying the environment now. Man has grown and farmed ever since man evolved. Don't shout at me. I'm saying that to trigger you. Don't shout at me. We farm forever. She's saying agriculture. We've got to stop agriculture. We've got to stop it now. Just use the fields to grow crops, but no more animal farming, she says. Anyway, what else does she say?
Causing the whole climate catastrophe. Now, it is more than all of transport put together. And we can no longer deny it. You know, what our diet has, you know, the impact that it has on our planet. So we cannot escape this climate catastrophe if we don't transition to a plant-based food system. And we're here to show our version of the future. So we're actually opening up a massive fruit and veg market. But not only that, we've got a lot of incredible vegan and plant-based meats and cheese and plant-based desserts vendors coming here because we're not here to take anyone's jobs. We're not here to...
Ah, but you are, though. You are. This is the thing. You are here to take people's jobs. You are, because once you start getting into that, you can't farm animals. Once you get into that, you've got to just grow crops and nothing else. You know, not to mention all the other foodstuffs that you think should be banned. You are, of course, putting millions upon millions, if not hundreds of millions of people out of work in a fell swoop, you know?
We're not here to do anything like that. This is really very peaceful, non-violent. And we're here just...
Well, it'll be violent in the lives of those affected by... Oh, Jesus.
Just to show that, you know, the workers in Smithfield... Yeah.
There's,
that they
there's
can...
a few signs that you've got up saying, yeah. You know, change to vegan, otherwise yeah. This planet will die. Why is that such an important...
Change to vegan or the planet will die.
Very
well,
quickly.
Unfortunately, that's the facts are all there. Animal agriculture is a destructive force to our planet. We breed billions, and I mean trillions, if you want to, you know, account for the fishing industry as well.
I'd love to be like her. I'd love to be able to say things like the facts are all there. But I can't, because in my job, when I speak with people and I say the facts are all there, the people I speak with ordinarily expect me to then produce such facts, those facts. I don't get away with that, you see. Listen, geoengineering is real. The facts are all there. When I say that to my friends, they don't accept that. they say, well, you've got to give me some facts. And I give them a few facts and we have a chat about it. But these days, you see, because these agendas are global and because they are being driven by the media, young, well-meaning women like young Ms. Lavelle there, they get to say things like the facts are all there and the reporter just smiles at them.
Animals into existence to feed the world over, because, you know, there's now 8 billion people to feed. So, you know, all the land that these animals take up, all the water, all the pollution, everything that goes on, all the disease that gets spread, and plus all these animals, you know, it's not a just system, it's not a nutritious system, and it's not a sustainable system.
What kind of fuckery are you?
It's brilliant. Facts are all there. Okay, thank you. Let's move on from the Extinction Rebellion madman, mad men, mad women, mad stuff. A US businesswoman called Jennifer Arcuri has stated clearly today, she might not be telling the truth, but she said, I didn't receive any favouritism when I knew Boris Johnson when he was Mayor of London. She said that he never failed to declare a conflict of interest because she got no favouritism. She wouldn't say whether or not they had an intimate relationship, but there's a few giggles. She was on with Piers Morgan or Susanna Reid. Yes, Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan on the Good Morning Britain programme on ITV. It is a bit of a lark. Susanna Reid with Piers Morgan and Jennifer Arcuri, this blonde businesswoman. I don't think her hair colour really is relevant at all, but Boris likes the blondes, I think, doesn't he? And they were speaking with her, and, well, one or two, as I said, points of interest in the conversation. Here we go.
Your office was where? I mean, it was in Shoreditch, but it was in your flat, right?
Yes, yeah. Which is very common for most startups.
Okay.
Right, and where was Boris living at the time? Because I'm trying to work out how it was on his way home.
He lived right next to Angel. So many times he would come up Bishopsgate, and Bishopsgate went into Shoreditch High Street, and it was an easy stop.
How many times?
Who the hell is Angel? That's what I want to know.
How many times did he visit your home?
Well, you mean my office?
Yes, your office.
My office had 1,200 square feet, and there were three little bedrooms. You know, there was plenty of office space for him to come visit, in which where he did come visit. And I've been asked this so many times. I'm not really sure how many times, but it's never like he stayed at any great length. Right? He was always late, and then I would say something about him being late, and he'd say, well, should I not have come at all? And then I was like, okay, well, you're here, so you've got 5 minutes.
But how many times roughly are we talking? 10, 20, 50? What would you say?
I mean, a handful.
What's a handful, Jennifer?
A handful over a few years? I mean, I don't really know. And it wasn't like he always came to my flat. Sometimes we would meet, you know, out in public. It just, I preferred it. I didn't like it because it always became, you know, a spectacle. Have you ever gone anywhere public with Boris?
Robbie, I mean, if the London mayor comes to your home, I mean, you're going to remember roughly how many times. I mean, it's 5, it's 10, it's 20. I mean, roughly. You're a smart lady. You know the answer.
Five times? 10 times? I mean,
10 times?
I mean,
it just
a
doubled.
Handful of times.
Handful of times. Does it matter how many times? Then Piers Morgan wanted to talk about her pole.
You have a pole, famously, in your home there in Shoreditch. What happens with that pole?
That I do. S-Factor classes were quite the rage, and I love core strength, so I tried it out. It was also one of those things when I started doing my startup, we would rent out on Airbnb, and I had such a great open space that it was a perfect conversation starter for most people. You know, they like to have drinks and they dance around the pole.
Did you ever use the pole when Boris was there?
Oh, God. No.
It's the kind of thing he'd love. Come on, it's the kind of thing he'd love, that.
Sounds like the kind of thing you'd love, Piers.
All men do, but no. If anything, I just, we'd always have a laugh about it. If anything, I asked him.
And he Boris didn't try and use it for a laugh.
I'm never going to tell you that.
Oh!
That's not exactly a categoric denial, is it, Miss Akiri?
Mm. Brilliant question in there. That was important, let's be honest.
Boris didn't try and use it for a laugh.
Yeah. Boris. Oh, Jesus. I was going to sing the song in Boris's voice, but I can't muster the energy to do it. I'm not even going to try, honest to God. Does it matter any of this? Look, they got to the nuts and bolts then, didn't they? At least I think they did. They talked about the alleged favours, and our Koori is adamant that she received nothing from him, whatever their relationship was.
Now I'm dragged into the middle of this horrific scandal, you know, and the answer that I'm going to give is now going to be weaponized against this man. It's really categorically no one's business what private life we had or didn't have, but and categorically more important, Boris never ever gave me favoritism. Never once did I ask him for a favor. Never once did he write a letter of recommendation for me. He didn't know about my asking to go to trips. He only knew me as an extremely passionate entrepreneur of the London tech scene.
Jennifer, we don't want to flog this part of it because we want to get to the more serious allegations.
You do,
just to put on the record, did you ever have any intimate relationship with Boris Johnson? Yes or no?
And because the press have made me this objectified ex-model pole dancer, I really am not going to answer that question.
So you won't deny it?
I'm sorry. I'm not going to be putting myself in a position for you to weaponize my answer.
No, I get it.
I'm being used as a pawn.
I don't want to use you as a weapon or a pawn or anything. It's simply that obviously the answer to that question is clearly relevant to the other questions we're going to ask you about the alleged impropriety, because the nature of your relationship is actually
but
a matter of public interest.
It's very interesting that it describes Piers Morgan, really. It shows him for what he is. He's an old newspaper editor. He isn't a presenter of any talent, because he says it's relevant to the questions we're going to ask you. He didn't listen to a thing she just said prior to that. She explicitly said prior to that that Johnson had nothing to do with anything that she did business-wise while she was in London. She couldn't have been more clear about it. But Morgan is not listening.
Public interest.
It's not.
There's a little tip for any of you who want to get into interviewing or broadcasting. You've actually got to listen to the person you're speaking with. It does help, you know. Jesus.
It's not. Categorically, Boris had nothing to do with all my other achievements.
Which he's already said five times.
Literally, someone has written down every single thing I've done in London and found a way to drive back to Boris.
Okay, well, we're going to come.
It's absolute crap, she said. Fair enough, and it might be. There are those who think this is designed to bring down Boris Johnson. It might be. I certainly do not know everything. I don't know more than you know. Maybe it is, but I'm not convinced that Boris Johnson is serious in his attempts to take the UK out of the European Union. So I don't know if it's meant to embarrass Johnson. Maybe it is. Maybe those who have engineered this story, because it's like I said the other day, if there's any validity to this, it shows you how the real deep state operates. It holds these nuggets of information about public life, men and women, to use in the event in the future they need to use them. It's like I said, you don't get to be an MP, let alone a Secretary of State, let alone the President, unless you are compromised horribly. They've got suitcases full and they've got filing cabinets full of dirt on all of these people. Oh, you can be sure they do. And this isn't a new thing. If there's anything there at all, if when he was Mayor of London, Johnson helped this woman gain some influence in some way, well then, he's in trouble. But it should speak to you about who really runs things. You know, because they keep all this stuff about people hidden, don't they? Until they need to use it. It's coming up for 8 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll be going live to New Zealand in about 10 minutes' time. I think you're going to really enjoy meeting my guest, Dr. Robin Kelly. I'm sure one or two of you will know who Robin is anyway. On the on Johnson, briefly, big story, a lot of coverage of it today, of course. Again, distracted the biggest story of the day, which is the hateful extremism story. But one of the big stories is this woman, Anne Sokoulis, Anne Sakoulis is wanted by the police because she was involved, allegedly, in the death of a young man on a motorcycle, a guy called Harry Dunn, back in August in Northamptonshire. It's alleged that she drove onto the road, turned the wrong way, went the wrong way, and hit Harry Dunn, who died in hospital shortly after. She disappeared back to the United States of America, and everybody is pissed off about that. She enjoys the same diplomatic immunity as her husband does. That's the way it goes. The family gets it as well. It has been alleged that she told the police that she would stick around. But it's also been alleged that that is true, but that her embassy told her to get on a plane and go back to the UK. The Mayor of London has been talking with Woody Johnson, the ambassador to the UK, the ambassador to the Court of St. James. And Boris Johnson is urging the United States to think pretty hard about this and possibly ask the woman or insist that she comes back to have a dialogue with the police. Here's Johnson today on this story.
Do not think that it can be right to use the process of diplomatic immunity for this type of purpose. And I hope that Anne Sakoulis will come back and will engage properly with the processes of law as they're carried out in this country. And that's a point that we've raised or are raising today with the American ambassador here in the UK, and I hope it will be resolved very shortly. And you know, to anticipate a question that you might want to raise, if we can't resolve it, then of course I will be raising it myself personally with the White House.
With Donald Trump. Apparently Mike Pompeo has spoken with the UK's foreign secretary today and has said that did I hear that just before coming on air? Trump hasn't been made aware of the story, apparently, as of yet. Whether it'll go any further or not, who knows? Mark Best is not convinced that Boris Johnson popped around to Jennifer's flat to do business or to talk about Shakespeare. A lot of people saying that there must have been something going on. If there was, it's their business. It's only not their business. It only becomes our business. So it does. Do you like that? It only becomes our business if there's any evidence suggesting that she benefited from the relationship. That she was given any favours of the financial kind. If she was introduced to people. If her business was given a contract or two or anything like that. Only then does the public have a right to know about it. Outside of that, it's between Johnson's ex-wife, Johnson, the woman, and it's nobody else's business. Base Ninja tweets, wow, these veggie fascists and middle-class fucktards could just protest, yet they keep the streets open, a la Hong Kong protesters. Yeah, I see what you're saying. They could protest and still keep the streets open like they do in Hong Kong. Yet they are just repeating BS, proving even arseholes have opinions, says Base Ninja there. Coming up for the top of the hour. Yeah. We're going to take a tune. And then we're going to move on and I will be introducing you to Dr. Robin. I can't wait to speak with him, by the way. Who's written this book. He's written three books, but he's written a book that I really want to read. It's Robin Kelly. He'll be in Auckland in New Zealand. It's approaching 6 o'clock Tuesday morning there. And a fair play to him for getting up early to have a chat with us. I came through Robin's work. I found out about him through the work of Richard Willett, the documentary filmmaker. So that's good as well. This is Elvis Presley, by the way. Why not, eh? Bit of Elvis. Yeah, the king of rock and roll. You see, there are very few radio stations, let alone radio programs, where you'll hear a bit of Elvis in the afternoons anymore. But we're a bit different here. We don't mind that. My guest is standing by in New Zealand, in Auckland. I'm really glad that he is. Just before we say a very quick hello to him, if there's a question you'd like me to put to him, please do so through Twitter. My Twitter handle is, of course, at Richie Allen Show. So if you want to put a question to Dr. Robin Kelly, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. You know that. Just before we welcome Robin to the programme, he's in Auckland in New Zealand, where it's about 6 o'clock in the AM tomorrow morning, Tuesday, because of where he is, of course, geographically. Fascinates me, that. Let me just let you in on a story that was in the Daily Mail today, which is good. I'm glad that it's getting some coverage. The headline is Town's War with 5G. Devonshire officials ban installation of new high-speed network after campaigners demand further research into its effects on health. This is a really good thing. And the man behind this, John Kitson, was in touch with me this morning. John was on the radio programme in the very recent past talking about this, John Kitson. So he was glad to get the coverage. I'll read two paragraphs of the article, then we'll welcome in Robin and we can talk more about it and what's happening in New Zealand. The push to roll out the latest 5G mobile technology across the country has hit a snag from angry residents in a quiet corner of Devon. The next generation of mobile internet connectivity is supposed to transform our lives by enabling the fastest speeds, most reliable connections on smartphones and other devices. But campaigners in Totnes claim it is a serious health hazard, and they have persuaded local officials to declare a moratorium on installing the high-frequency network. Although the decision has no force in planning law, campaign leader John Kitson claims the action by Totnes Town Council is a warning to ministers that they cannot bring in 5G without further research into its effects. Mr. Kitson, who left the recruitment industry to become a full-time 5G activist, said, "Everyone is talking about 5G, the driverless cars, Wi-Fi speed and the Internet of Things, such as fridges linked to the web, and yet proper research on this technology hasn't been carried out. Telecom companies, Public Health England, the World Health Organization say no adverse effects on human health have been established. But there have been thousands of peer-reviewed scientific papers which raise concern. More than 250 scientists have urged the European Union to halt the rollout of 5G because it means a huge increase in electromagnetic radio frequencies on top of the existing network." And John Kitson has been on the programme. You'll find those interviews on YouTube. My guest today, and big shout out to him for getting up early, although he's probably up anyway, to come on the programme. For over three decades, he has integrated Western, Eastern and modern mind-body concepts into his own medical practice in Auckland. He's a past and current co-president of the Medical Acupuncture Society and a founding trustee of New Zealand's Mind-Body Trust. He has written three books, I think. If he's written more, I apologise now. But a fascinating book, which was hugely well received, entitled The Human Hologram, Living Your Life in Harmony with the Unified Field. That is the next book I am going to read. I'm telling you, I can't wait to read it. I was introduced to him by Richard Willett, the filmmaker who's been on this programme before. Delighted to welcome to the programme, live in New Zealand, on Tuesday morning, no less, Dr. Robin Kelly. Robin, thanks for coming on the programme. How are you?
Hi, Richie.
Thanks for coming on. And I appreciate you getting up so
early. I've got a bit of echo here, but I hope you can hear me. That's good.
Now, I can hear you loud and clear, and I don't have any echo.
That's brilliant.
If so, we can proceed. Tell us about... We saw in Brussels recently, we'll talk about your own work and research into these technologies and your books. Of course we will. But of late, we've had a couple of interesting things happen. Obviously, in Brussels, the environment minister said, let's stop testing the technology. Let's not use people as guinea pigs. And now in Totnes, as I've just been talking about, they've said, OK, let's have a look at this again. Does this give you hope when you see this? Are activists and academics who are concerned about 5G, are they making a bit of a headway, Robin?
Yes, I think they are around the world. And I think if you talk to most people, most regular people, they would totally agree with us, where they totally say that it's not worth threatening our lives, but more particularly the lives of our children and future generations, for something that we don't quite understand how good it's going to be for our lives. Most of us are struggling to have good lives. But all this, if you explain it to the average person, they say, well, you know, this is crazy. This, my life is enhanced by my relationships with other people, walking outside, walking the dog, having a laugh. What on earth is all this about? Who's making these decisions that these things are so important in our lives? And that's the average person that I'm meeting. And I'm sure it's possibly the person you're meeting as well, saying, well, what on earth is this about?
Do those behind it, the manufacturers and the lobbyists who work hard to, I suppose, circumvent governments or local authorities to roll it out, do you think they are aware that it might be harmful to people, or are they oblivious to that, and is their motivation high speeds and profit? What do you think?
Well, I think their motivation is high speed and profits, and I've written to many of them, and I'm convinced they know the problem and the issue. And the how I approached them, I said, look, you have a family, you have children, this is the science of what we've already got, and we're going into these unknown territories. Is this a sacrifice you would want to make for your family and your children? And they go silent on that. So it's a weird phenomenon where they seem to have compartmentalized all the profit away from their own health and their own health of their families. I'm convinced they know this. I know that they know there's a race on, that the information is coming out loud and clear. Of course, we haven't got information on 5G. It hasn't been tested. But there's a plenty of information on what we're already being exposed to, which has been accumulative issues over the last 20 or 30 years. And this is going to add on to them. I think they knowingly advising the our ministers and our governments wrongly. I think I've been writing to them and getting certain replies over the last 2 years, and it's clear they're avoiding the issues when I send them the science. They have no answer to the science, and they're hearing it loud and clear, but the profit motive seems to be uppermost in, well, their drive. It's uppermost, it's their biggest drive in their life, and this is very, very sad, and brings all sorts of philosophical issues into this problem.
Dr. Robin Kelly is our guest. He's live on the line from Auckland in New Zealand. There are lots of tweets already. By the way, many of my listeners, they laugh at me, Robin. Many of my listeners got in touch today to say that they've heard about you before and they've read The Human Hologram. Specifically, a lot of people telling me they read the book. I'm always the last to know, you see. But that's no bad thing. It's great to have an active and engaged audience there. So if you believe they know, I mean, I've worked as a journalist for many, many years, and every now and then a corporation that has produced a harmful product gets undone by a memo that is leaked by a former member of staff or a former director, a memo that highlights the fact that they did know that the product was harmful. We remember the famous tobacco memos about nicotine being addictive and stuff like that. You've got to hope or expect that somebody within the industry is going to break cover and say, look, yeah, we do know that this stuff is harmful and we are pushing it.
Yes, you'd hope that. And the reason I'm writing to these people and emailing it is that I'm chronicling it. So therefore, they know that I know, and they have all this on record. And their response is either no response or a standardized response that's been fed to, say, to the government by the industry, which is full of deceptions and omissions. And there are certain things that have happened recently that convince me that they do know that they're actively lying. And it took me a long time to come to that conclusion. I'm not somebody who is that suspicious of people. I've always thought that maybe we could educate them and they could say, aha, I see the light. But in fact, there is now they know this issue. They know how other countries like Cyprus are engaged in making sure that the existing Wi-Fi isn't, that their children aren't exposed to existing Wi-Fi. So they know all this. And even despite that, they're going to carry on.
They know. And you sent me some very interesting stuff overnight, emails, which prove that they know. And I was very grateful to receive that. There's no doubt. There's no need for a smoking gun. You know, we know about the tumours in the rats, and we know about the effects it has on children. I've had any number of people over the years, doctors, academics. Robin Kelly is our guest. Lots of comments coming in. I'll just break briefly just to read one or two of these tweets, because we'll get behind with them. Richard Willett is listening with great interest to this and is working on a film about this. And you're working on a film yourself, aren't you, Robin? It might be the same film.
Yeah, I think, It's being planned as well, And Richard, I was talking to Richard last night about it. So, so hopefully that will happen. And although here in New Zealand, they're beginning the rollouts, they're tying it up with the America's Cup. It's such a, we're being barraged by this 5G. But if you talk to the average person, they really don't know what it's about.
They haven't a clue. David Stanford has a brilliant comment on Twitter. He talks about councils and schools and insurance. That's a great point to make. You would imagine, I mean, if I was running a school or running a council, I'd be very wary of litigation in the future. Do you get that sense, Robin, from schools and councils that they're looking at this thinking, well, we better be careful here, because if this stuff is harmful, we're somehow liable if we're putting it in classrooms and stuff. What do you think?
Absolutely, yes. I think that's very important. I work in a student health department at a university as well, and I put this to the health and safety directors, and they know full well. And we have legislation now, health and safety legislation, something that I haven't always welcomed because there's been so much paperwork and it's got a bit finicky. But ultimately, if somebody, irrespective of the science, if doctors come out and say they're concerned, then we have reported a potential health and safety issue. And the person that doesn't listen is liable to a fine up to $3 million out here. So you would like to think that it would be actually their concern for our health and safety and the health and safety of children and future generations. But I probably how this is going to play out is there's going to be a threat to their pockets.
A threat to their pockets, that's right. I wonder, I interviewed a young woman last year called Susanna Small. I don't know if that name is familiar to you, Susanna Small. And Susanna is concerned about the effects of electromagnetic frequencies, non-ionising radiation and its effects on the body. And she had a bit of a run-in with her local GP. And her local GP didn't want to hear any of this, didn't want to contemplate it. And Suzanne said, well, look, I'm not having it. And she sent a barrage of emails to the doctor linking to some of the studies that you're aware of. And the next thing she knew, there were some people outside her front door. And she got to spend a few days under psychiatric evaluation. She was sectioned effectively. And by some bizarre set of circumstances, she was able to come on this radio program from the psychiatric facility in Surrey and talk to me. And it was all very mad and funny and weird at the time and not so funny and scary. But it got me thinking, we're in 2019, you know that non-ionising radiation has a harmful effect on the body. But it seems to me that you're in the minority, Dr. Kelly. The vast majority of physicians are telling people, listen, this is cloud cuckoo land, tinfoil hat stuff, it's okay. There's still, it seems to be that consensus, don't worry about it, nothing to see here.
It's a huge concern, and we've got a group of physicians here, probably 15 or 20 of us who get it. And they're mostly doctors that are what we call integrative doctors. They're also using, they're not just using drug medicine. They're looking at lifestyle, they're looking at diet, they're looking at, in some ways, supplements that have had scientific backing, and others like us who have done acupuncture. And they know there's a much broader issues, a much bigger issue to see. Now, I have to say that every human being is electrosensitive. We're all electrosensitive. We're all on a spectrum of being sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies. There are some, though, that are electro-hypersensitive. They're very sensitive, and it's real. And I've had people come to me, and I've been really struggling to help them. I've been looking at ways of helping them, and it's been very, very difficult. They've really had to isolate themselves, and so through my work, which is starting to do acupuncture in the early 80s, integrating that into my practice, I realize how sensitive people are. There's maybe a range of 1,000 points of sensitivity in people. Wow. Some have like rhino hides, but most people are terribly sensitive, and the most sensitive are children, and of course women in pregnancy as well. And some that you would just with your acupuncture needle just almost touch the point, and they feel the whole meridian light up. Where others you have to work on. So every day I have had experience of how sensitive people are. The other thing is that we know that we live in a set of frequencies on this in this world. They're called the Schumann resonances, and they're way down the scale in the 7 to 10 hertz range. So we actually live in an environment which is conducive to health and healing, and we're ramping up and really changing that environment away from that healing point where our bodies are comfortable, where we feel most at ease. All this is very good science. All this is exactly known. But by the average GP, no, because most of doctors are being conditioned into a feeling that we are chemical beings rather than electrochemical beings or electrical beings or energy beings. And that's the way they've been processed. And therefore, all this seems to be outside their area of expertise. And then we're getting, in our medical journal here, we're getting so-called experts filling them full of false information, which I showed you that last night. And that's shocking because they're already primed to dismiss it. And now they've got the so-called experts really reassuring them that it's all right to dismiss it. And that's a terrible state of affairs.
It is, and we can talk more about that in the time we have. Dr. Robin Kelly is our guest, and Robin is very well known in this field and in other fields. He's written three books, including The Human Hologram, Living Your Life in Harmony with the Unified Field. It is the next book I'm going to read, Robin, for sure. I can't wait to get stuck into it, because this is an area of interest that's been growing for me in recent years. I wouldn't have called myself a Luddite now, but I would have been very dismissive in the past of... other ideas. I would have been mired in one way of thinking. So before we move on, we're going to stay with this. What was your epiphany then? I mean, medically trained, a doctor, how did you come to understanding what you've just described about the frequencies and us being, beings of electricity and light? How did you get to that? Because your peers must, have been looking at you rather quizzically at the time. What's happening to Robin there? So how did you end up on this path?
Well, it's interesting. I was trained in London, and I spent 3 years in the 70s in London and around London in hospital work. And then I came to New Zealand, and I did 3 years there, mostly looking after kids, and which I loved. But I went into general practice, and I was really felt at home there. Very soon after starting in general practice, the other doctor I was working with had been to China for 3 months and learnt acupuncture, and I was very impressed with what he was doing. Now, but tragically, after a few months, he died suddenly. He was only 42. So, observing this, I had a lot of people, a lot of patients that said, "Hey, Robin, why don't you start to do it?" And I was fascinated, and I started to do it, and I took some training, and I noticed some very exciting things happening. People come in with sore necks and sore backs. I'd give them a couple of pins and they'd walk out feeling better. And not only that, they'd phone me the next day and say, hey, Robin, I've had the best night's sleep I've ever had. Or so maybe a woman who's having heavy periods was saying, look, my periods were improved. So I thought, heck, there's something going on here. And I was never that keen on prescribing a lot of drugs. And in those days, in the early 80s, the drugs were even more toxic than they are now. There were very heavy drugs for pain, there were for blood pressure, whatever. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to start using this and trying to reduce the number of medications people are on so they felt better, they didn't feel in a haze? And that was really my study. Over the next 10 years or so, I investigated this, and there were a small group of doctors like me, and we investigated not just how to use acupuncture, but to investigate the source of acupuncture. What was their philosophy over thousands of years that led them into this way of treating people? And I integrated it so that people came on in heavy drugs, we would be able to reduce the medication down. Then after 10 years, I found it more and more difficult to do it in general practice because and it's still crazy, the consultations are far too short. all you can do in general practice really is to meet the expectations of the person in front of you. You can't guide them into maybe, it's not easy to guide them into another better lifestyle, whatever. So I started a specific general practice with my wife at my home, giving me much more time to listen to people. And that's where it took off in many ways, because I started to study Ayurvedic medicine and the Hindu philosophy and the chakras and others, and found that there's great stuff here that we could start using in our practice that benefits people, because basically you're talking the language of the people. You're not coming over with all some sort of information that a doctor knows and the person doesn't know. This very much relates to their lives. This is the story. This is how their emotions are affecting their health.
This is hugely. I did get
some stick then. You could probably realize. I started to write some books.
I was just going to ask you that. I was going to say you must have encountered some resistance. This is not good for some people and for some organizations. How did that manifest, the resistance? Was it difficult?
Well, the way I responded to it, and luckily I had colleagues, and you build up colleagues around the world who are doing the same. So you get a collegiate of other doctors and a small number that were on the right, well, I think the right track. So I started to write some books to say, hey, no, you're not. This doesn't mean that we're going to throw away the best of Western medicine, which is brilliant at diagnosis, as you know. But it does mean that if we start combining all these things together, you get a far better mix, and you can help people far more. Not only that, you can give them more responsibility. They can take responsibility. But, most of the stuff that I do is based on listening. You just sort of, I have a minimum consultations of half an hour. First time I see somebody for an hour and a half or so, you listen to their lives, you listen to how their ill health, in fact, has come out of certain traumas in their lives. A lot of this good energy work is listening, just listening with an open heart and an open mind.
I love this. I mentioned to you that our family doctor back in Waterford is in her mid-80s.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and you could never get a prescription out of her either. Back in the day, she was the enemy of the country's drug representatives. They didn't like her very much. I'm guessing by listening to you, Robin, you were the same. We're going to segue into a few areas. I'm definitely going to invite, we've got till the top of the hour. If you want to stay with me for the top of the hour, I'd be really grateful if you could. But if you've got to go at any time, I totally understand as well. But if you can stick with us for the hour, and in the future we can do another show in the near and get into other things, because the listeners are now bombarding me with stuff. They're loving this and they want to hear more about it. But before we go back to 5G, and I'm really sorry now for segueing to the listeners who want to talk about 5G, I've got to ask you about vaccines. And I'm going to first of all say, I have my hand on a holographic Bible, and I'm swearing on the invisible Bible that I'm not I'm not lying. I am not anti-vaccine. I never have been. I'm not qualified to be anti or pro-vaccine. I'm worried. The things are happening in Ireland, which is obviously where I come from, and I know people, and I know there's been an adverse reaction to Gardasil. I know there has. And I'm worried that, I mentioned our doctor, Dr. Farrell, who, I don't want to be speaking out of school, and I don't want to be attributing things to my old family doctor or anybody else, but I know that those doctors are pretty horrified now that we're given 13 or 14 vaccines to children before they get to 5 or 6 years of age. And I just wonder about the necessity of that. And I wonder about how bad could it be to get measles as a kid and then get over it like we all did. And I wonder about vaccines. And, you're the GP. You have integrated all these different attitudes towards medicine around the world into your own practice. You're doing it successfully. You're the best man, I think, to ask about vaccines. I trust you to give me an honest answer. What do you think about vaccines? Too many? What's happening?
Yeah, I tell you what my practice is, that if anybody wants to vaccinate their child or doesn't want to, they spend an hour with me and we go through everything. We go through, because it's really complicated. We go through the literature, we go through those bits of paper that come with the vaccines. And I suppose a lot of people that are coming to talk to me are actually wary of vaccinations in this practice. But they also, they're not anti-vax. They're wary of too many vaccines. And I think where doctors have gone wrong is that here you have a mother who brings a beautiful little baby into the world and is breastfeeding the baby. And she and the father want to keep this baby as pure as possible. I mean, that is the deepest instinct that probably humans have is the maternal instinct from a mother to a child. So the first thing is that it must be perfectly natural for them to say, hey, I don't want my child to be injected from the ear dot with all sorts of things. And then to be found then in 10 or 20 years to find that this is the wrong thing to do. They are the advocates for their child. And I think where the medical profession has gone wrong is it's alienated people. They're not anti-vaccination, they're pro-children, they're pro. And the other thing is that we do know that vaccines aren't 100% effective. So we're asking a lot of a mother and a father to do this for the sake of a population. That also goes against a very deep, loving, intuitive feeling from them. Now, if you start appreciating all that, you get a dialogue with the person. And what I've found is that what usually happens is that those who don't want to use any vaccinations become selective in what they want for their child. And I base that on the science, but also my own experience. I had all the childhood illnesses and now have, say, for measles, I'm completely protected. Now, there were dangers in the old days of having measles, but there was about a 1 in 10,000 chance that you'd get an encephalitis. And we all knew that. And I knew that at medical school. And in those days, it wasn't perfect, where people who had their tonsils out, 14 children a year died of having their tonsils out. So these weren't perfect times in any ways. But what's happened with, say, the measles vaccination is those who didn't have the measles but had the vaccinations, the mothers do not carry that immunity onto the child in the first year. So the children, the babies, who are susceptible, are in fact the ones most at risk at the moment. And that wasn't known also when we started vaccinations. So yes, I believe in vaccinations. Do I think there are too many? Well, my home experience feels, yes, there are too many, that now we're bombarding people with a cumulative load of vaccinations. And I'd have to say most doctors of my age and older are saying, heck, you know, have we gone too far with this? And most would agree. The younger doctors, unfortunately, are probably conditioned into saying that's fine. But the interesting fact is that the flu vaccinations in our local hospital are being turned down by our junior doctors. They don't want them. Somewhere along the line, they're not, I think deep down, they're concerned as well.
Thanks for that answer, Robin. Dr. Robin Kelly is our guest. A very famous man. I won't name him. Everybody who's listening will know who he is, but I won't name him. But a very famous man once said, and he's not a doctor, he said, I struggle with the notion of, before we go back to 5G, which is what we need to do, he said, I struggle with the idea of taking an underdeveloped immune system, and his words were, and I often use them, I don't claim them to be mine, he said, overwhelming the underdeveloped immune system with a tidal wave of toxic shit, basically. You couldn't categorize him as anti-vaccine either, but he says a lot of these ingredients, these adjuvants, how could it be good for a child that's not really got a robust immune system yet? So final question on that, is there some merit in him saying that the underdeveloped immune system can't take these ingredients or some of them? And maybe we should look at only giving very necessary vaccines to children when they're maybe a good deal older and their bodies are better able to process the vaccine itself.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit in that as well. But I think also reading up about this, there's always been those people of concern with vaccinations. In the 1800s, there was in Leicester, there was a revolt against the smallpox vaccination. 80 to 100,000 people marched in the city objecting to it. So people who have been concerned about vaccinations have been there since the beginning when people started vaccinating, which was the early 1800s. So that's one thing. And I think they also realize now, the authorities realize, if they mandate vaccinations, if they make them compulsory, there'll be such a backlash from people that it's actually going to have, it's not going to do what they want them to do, what they want to happen. They won't get that 100% cover. It will actually only bring it to the attention of more and more people. So I agree. I think that we have to be careful about this, and also, like I apply the precautionary principle to the whole 5G thing, we have to apply the precautionary principle to how we're vaccinating, and first do no harm. And we're learning more and more about the how sensitive the immune system is in a young baby, to the point that we now are very wary of prescribing antibiotics where they're not needed. We know that if we give antibiotics, even for a week, to a young child, it affects how their the normal gut flora in their bowel. So that can affect not only their immune development, but their brain development as well, just from a week of antibiotics. We know that about paracetamol, that we shouldn't be taking away fevers all the time, because fevers are part of the natural body's response. All this is revolutionizing how we treat children. And we have to be very humble in this. We have to know how little we know and how science is advancing. And I think that's the cornerstone of our concern, is that we're plowing ahead with things with an arrogance that we know everything. We don't. We only know a little bit of everything.
It's a lovely sentiment, that. Dr. Robin Kelly is our guest. We'll put Robin's website details on Twitter and on the Facebook page as well, and links to Robin's books. Right, just before we go back to 5G, and we do have time, we've got about 20 minutes or so left. Just very briefly, Robin, again, thanks for your time this morning. I'm really enjoying having you on the programme. I say this morning, it's 25 to 7 in the evening here in the UK. It's Tuesday morning there in New Zealand, which I've never visited New Zealand, but it's always been one place, because a friend of mine in primary school many years ago used to leave primary school for 3 months of the year because his dad used to go and work in New Zealand, and he used to bring back photographs of the place. So it's always been on my mind. I want to ask you about this. Tonight on British television, a film will be shown for 3 minutes right across the networks about mental health. And you've got the royal family, princes and their wives and actors talking about mental health. And they've launched an initiative, which is where they want everybody to go online to answer some questions about their mental health, and they'll be given some sort of guidance or whatever. Now, look, because I've got a small tinfoil hat, it's a small one, Robin, but I've got one. Mm. I'll be the first. I find this stuff very sinister. And I've been a journalist for many years, and I've noticed in recent years there has been a lot of talk. In fact, a Sky News presenter today admitted herself that all they seem to be talking about lately is about mental health. If it's not every day, it's every other week. And I get very worried about that. They actually claimed today that 80% of the UK population is at the moment suffering from or has suffered from some mental health problem. I just don't like that. I find it a little bit creepy. I don't think that's true. I think they are categorising certain things as mental health problems when in fact they are everyday life problems. But who am I to talk? I'll ask you for your opinion, and then we'll go back to 5G.
Yeah, and I think probably could be related to 5G and what we're talking about as well, because there's another whole aspect of 5G, but I'll come back to that. Yeah. What another part of my work is working in student health. And I would totally agree that the struggles that a young person is having going to university, often coming out of a broken home, away from home or whatever, these are real life challenges. And they're being medicalized to a certain point. And so many are coming at the age of 18 on medication. They've been on medication for ADHD, and they've also been on medication with antidepressants, which incidentally are really not indicated in young people, because we know that because of the higher risk of suicide ideation. So we've basically been medicalizing people's response to difficult situations, and that may not be particularly helpful for their resilience in the future. In fact, it happens from very early age, where people, children are prevented from having even the usual childhood injuries of twisting their ankle, falling off some swinging bar. We've got these regulations. So we now have, and the real epidemic that we're having is the epidemic of anxiety in young people. Now, that anxiety is that they're anxious, but they don't know why they're anxious. It's coming from all sides. And in fact, the media has a part to play in this, because the media, particularly the news, is there trying to make everybody anxious, to lock them in, I think, to sitting down in front of the box in the evening. So the anxiety is real. So they're getting to a point where they're anxious about everything, and then they're anxious about being anxious. We are responding to this, I think, in not the best way. They have found that there's a big issue here in New Zealand, where we had what we call the well-being budget that addresses this. But the way they wanted to address it is to put more counsellors out there. Now, the more counsellors there are, we know that actually the more that are referred back to the doctor and they end up on drugs, on medication. We're not looking at what's happening in society, what's happening to particularly our media has a huge part to play in this. And I think coming back with now saying, look, we've got a mental health problem, and not looking at themselves and their role in it, I think would probably be quite upsetting to you and others.
I've been a bit, you've made me feel bad now, and maybe I deserve it. I've been very dismissive. I'm 44 now, and I've been dismissive of the so-called snowflake generation. And I've been condescending in my approach to them because of the way they react to, I don't know, confrontation or disagreement. And maybe I need to accept that there's a bit of engineering going on there, that it's not a natural state for them to want to avoid those who disagree with them. It's not a natural state for them to just kind of delve into identity politics. Maybe I'm being a bit tough on them. Maybe environmental factors are at play. And, you've categorized earlier on, you talked about what we are, the makeup of our bodies, which many doctors or most doctors don't understand. And maybe things like exposure to electromagnetic frequencies, constantly surrounded by your phone or your tablet, maybe this is playing havoc with the emotions of younger people. I hate to say younger people in a patronizing way, but maybe, and we come full circle back again to Wi-Fi, 4G, 3G and now 5G, and how that's affecting the moods and the demeanors of younger people.
Yeah, I think there is that.
I hope we've not lost Robin now. Hang on a second.
With social media, the digit.
Sorry, Robin, we lost you momentarily. We only lost you for two seconds. You're back. My apologies. We lost you for a second.
Did you lose?
I've got you back.
On again?
No, you're back in the room loud and clear. I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. I think the people that I'm seeing, say the 18 and 19-year-olds, have all been born in this millennium, and they are the digital natives as well. And they have been brought up to relate to each other through social media, not through actually one-to-one talking. If I sit down and talk to an 18 or 19-year-old for half an hour, that may be the first time an adult has been talking to them in this way. And so I think I have to get on side with them. I have to become listen to them. So I have to take, a more empathetic approach as well, to listen to them and hear them. But
call has just dropped out again momentarily.
Personal contact. They're longing for this.
Robin, sorry.
Oh, dear.
No,
it
you
must
just,
be the sky.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm going to very briefly disconnect from you and then reconnect. That sometimes works. It's a very old school fix, that, I've just disconnected from Dr. Robin Kelly. It's robinkelly.co.nz, by the way, .co.nz. That's the website. And sometimes that works, Robin, so it might work. So,
hello.
Yeah, I've got you back. We're back live. Thanks for your patience there. Can you hear us loud and clear?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, lovely, lovely, loud and clear. Okay. You were just before you got cut off, you were talking about dealing with and treating this millennial generation who are probably the first generation to grow up with all of this atmospheric noise, all of this electromagnetic noise around them.
Yeah. There are many levels to this. I've said they're the digital natives, I think they call them, which so they are basically a generation who communicated to each other through social media. And it's a rarity for somebody to sit down, which I try to do for half an hour, and listen to them. So that is a rarity. And in fact, that very act being unusual for them is something that can shift them away from taking medication. All you have to do is listen to them. And I say, I'm showing them empathy. I have to, you know, you're the doctor. You're not there in any confrontational way. Yeah, I'm having insights into them, and they are our future. So I believe our generation has to help them, has to be like the elders of old, which has always happened in society, that the elders and the other generation, the next generation, has helped the ones before. And we learn from them, of course, as well, because, you know, they're interesting and they have their own slant on the world.
Yeah, it's a lovely way of putting it. Yeah, it gives me food for thought. I often end up in monologues and news roundups lampooning some of the things that you read. But then it's coming from a media. Of course, it's not coming from the source. It's often coming from a tabloid newspaper where youngsters have been mocked for their sensitivities. And maybe I need to look at that in a different way. I'll be the first to admit that. Robin, the website is robinkelly.co.nz. That's the one it keeps giving me, .co.nz. That's where I've been directing people. If there's another one, let me know. But I want to mention...
No, that'll do.
That'll do. And I want to mention again Robin's book, because it really was well received, and it's as relevant now as it ever was. The Human Hologram, Living Your Life in Harmony with the Unified Field, is one of several books written by Robin, and I'd love to have you back on in the future to talk about the themes in the book after I've read it, which I will do. This, how serious is this exposure to the electromagnetic frequency given off by 5G? How serious? And what I love about listening, and of course I listened to some other interviews in prep for this, I've been looking at you over the last few days, you're very non-judgmental and you're not at all hysterical. You're very calm and reasonable and measured. How serious could it be, an epidemic for human health, if this stuff is rolled out, and why?
Gosh, well, first of all, we're going totally into the unknown, and we're going very quickly. We're going quickly into this really for profit for the big companies. That's why. And there's always a warning sign when that happens, when the people's own development and conscious development is being somewhat hijacked into this. I'm not at all anti-technology. I believe that our consciousness and the technology and the internet go hand in hand. But we have a huge responsibility with this stuff. So am I worried? Yes, because I think it's ramping things up. And I think we have to realize that 5G isn't just those higher frequencies at higher pulse modulations into areas, microwave areas that we haven't experienced before. But it's on top of everything that we've been exposed to over the last 30 plus years. And that's the problem, because it also includes some of the lower frequencies. And what is happening is that we're becoming more and more understanding that those lower frequencies don't just cause heat in the body. That's not the worst thing that happens. They cause non-thermal effects. And the science has got to a point to being pretty well clear that this stuff is toxic to the body unless we limit it. And when we start adding things to it, it's the opposite to what we need to do. Those studies that show that rats get heart tumors from the exposure to cell phones, basically that's not talking about 5G, that's talking what we've got already. But if that gets out, if you like, that's going to affect the whole momentum of this push to roll out this fifth generation of 5G. It's not just cancer that we're worried about, it's actually how it's going to impact on a whole energetic system. Most of the science isn't talking about energy, it's talking about the chemical changes that occur in cells, that we get what we call oxidative stress, release of these reactive oxygen species, which are actually involved in pretty well all chronic illness that we have. But we've also got, what is it doing to our emotional and mental health as well? Are we being ramped up? Is this anxiety that we're feeling going to be made worse? Is it going to be a tipping point for people who are just at the edge? People's immune systems, through complex trauma that they've had in their lives and that we've inherited, are we at a tipping point where this could tip a huge number of the population over into all manner of ill health? And I believe that's a real risk, that we've got the real risk there of that happening. And also we've got, you know, noticing the anxiety in younger people. There may be a direct link, because we know that from studies that are coming out of Israel, in that these very high frequency range, this sub terahertz range, 300 gigabytes or whatever, that if you expose students to that, and it's done on students, their sweat glands resonate with the 5G, the higher frequencies, and they produce more water. And so the body becomes an antenna for this, for this wow. radiation.
That's amazing.
An antenna internally and externally as well. So what have we got? What happens when we're anxious? We sweat. So those people already anxious who are going to be in this environment, particularly at night when they're trying to sleep, their anxiety can be ramped up. What are we doing to that? Now, all that's some good science. It needs to be repeated, but it's being repeated. So on so many levels, this is an experiment on humans that the like of which we've never seen before.
Are you, you're a young man still. You are. You've done a lot in your career. No, but you are. You are. I'm not patronizing you. You're a young man. You talked earlier on about doctors. You know, we've got National Health Service doctors. And I do believe, because like you, I tend to see the best in people, except young people. I give young people a hard time, but I'm going to stop now. I'm going to rein myself in after speaking with you. But I generally do see the best in people. And I don't believe that there is great badness in the doctors that we've got in the NHS today, the younger ones. I think things have changed in the way they are educated in universities, and I worry about that. I don't think they're encouraged to be exploratory, to be curious, to spend... We know they're not encouraged to spend time with people, because we've seen all the memorandums, and those of us who go, we know that we've only got 5 minutes, they've got to make a diagnosis, and they're under so much pressure. It's a terrible thing. It's almost like a factory. So, is there a question there? There is. We need men and women like you coming through, Robin. Are they coming through who are going to take up the mantle? You've still got plenty to do in the next years in your life and decades, but what about the young men and women coming behind you? Or is the madness of life and a career and staying afloat and paying the mortgage, is it going to be problematic? Because we need more people to say, yes, we need to take this on.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. I have medical students coming to my practice, and they love what I'm doing, and they fall in love with it, and they say, I'd like to do this. But when they qualify, they come out with a big student debt.
Yeah.
In Auckland, like in many places, the house prices and the rents are huge. So they don't. They graduate into doing session work at accident and emergency places in preference. And in fact, you know, the situation is so tough for them, and it always has been for us as well, that they are unable financially to spend half an hour with people like I do, you know, just on the first instance. So they are basically drawn into the other specialties, which are basically often using tubes to look in various orifices, human orifices.
Yeah, yeah.
So because, to be honest, you can earn from doing that for a quarter of an hour what I would be doing in 3 hours. Of course, I love what I'm doing. I'm not criticizing that at all. But if you've got their bills to pay, there's a problem. So there's a real issue. And their hearts, often I'm finding where their heart is going and where the medical profession is driving them are two different places. And what's happening is that they're dropping out. The most empathetic, best doctors are dropping away. And that is not good either. It's not good for the doctors. So I have a huge amount of time for those students who are trying to do this work, and they're fascinated by it, by and large. But only a very, very small proportion will be able to do what I'm doing. I don't know anybody in my local area who now is doing what I'm doing. But they're not also having the... I don't think they're as passionate about their work as I am.
Yeah, and you know, it echoes my memories of... And you're much, much younger, but it echoes my memories of our family doctor. Loads and loads of time. And it was something... The last time I saw her, which was some years ago now... that I was very, you know, I noticed. I remember coming over here and going to a doctor, and the National Health doctor, you got your few minutes, you got your prescription, and you were hurried out the door, not so much as a kick on the backside. That's it, you're done, you know. But I remember 35, 40 minute consultations, questions, you know, the doctor knowing the community, knowing the people, knowing their families, knowing what was going on in their lives. You talked about this earlier on, the importance of this. It really resonated with me. You talking about listening to your patients and how that is so as much a part of them healing or dealing with whatever ailment they might have as well, the positive benefits of that. And that's why I said to you in the email the other day, this silly phrase of old school versus modern medicine. Mm. Old school people, plenty and plenty of time, a genuine understanding of the patient. There won't be an NHS doctor now in Salford, in Greater Manchester, where I am, that will know the first thing about any of the patients on his or her roster. They won't know anything. That's a real indictment, isn't it? I mean, you know your patients' names, their families, their likes, their loves, their dislikes, where they go on holiday. You know that stuff. It's vitally important. We've lost all that.
We've lost all that. And in my lifetime as a GP, it's changed radically. Really, in the 80s and 90s, well, first part of the 90s, the doctor's job, and it's still my job, is to help the person who's in front of them. It's changed radically into the doctor being helping the community and towing the community line, if you like. So you've got to keep up with the immunization schedules. You've got to prescribe this and prescribe that in a prescribed sort of way, in a dogmatic sort of way. So it's gone away from individual care into community care. And I've seen that. And it's something that I do spend a day or two doing general practices for friends to keep my hand in that in some ways. And that helps them, my medical counsel here. But ultimately, it's a very different medicine. I'm finding that I'm drawn into screening for a population rather than spending time with the person in front of me, listening to them. I personally believe we should look after the person in front of them. They can sort the community out. It's not my job to sort the community out. It's my job to resonate and listen and help the person who's in front of me.
I'd love to explore that point with you. That's a bombshell to end on, by the way, because that's huge. That's a whole show on its own, what you just talked about there, and the implications of that for society. Robin, thanks for coming on. It's flown by this 55 minutes or so. robinkelly.co.nz. That's robinkelly.co.nz. You've been listening to Dr. Robin Kelly in Auckland. Remarkable conversation this. And I want to mention the book again. The books, but The Human Hologram, Living Your Life in Harmony with the Unified Field. We've talked about the body with other academics and other doctors before. I'd love to talk more about that in the near future with you, with your permission, Robin. All I can say today is thanks for coming on. Have a brilliant rest of your Tuesday. And I'd really love to get into this with you again in a few weeks' time when you've got another hour to spare some morning there in Auckland. Thanks, mate. I really appreciate it.
I really loved it. Thank you, Richie.
Great stuff, Robin. Thanks. And thanks to Richard Willett for making films and documentaries and featuring you, because without him, I would never have come across you. And I'm so glad I did. Cheers, Robin. Bye for now. That was Dr. Robin Kelly live on the line in Auckland there. In New Zealand, it's just coming up for 7 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday morning there. So much we could have gotten into with Robin, but I will invite him back real soon. I'm a man of my word too. I've ordered The Human Hologram, Living Your Life in Harmony with the Unified Field, because I'm really fascinated by that. Thanks to those of you who've commented and sent messages as well. To see what other people were tweeting me, go to Twitter, where it says search Twitter. Put Richie Allen Show, all one word, just Richie Allen Show, all one word. And if you press enter, you'll get a list of all the tweets that people have sent me. And John Byrne has just tweeted a link to a video where a video that discusses what Robin Kelly mentioned, which was the bit about 5G and sweat and the effect it has on us, on our bodies and our sweat glands. So check that out. I've just retweeted that there. robinkelly.co.nz. Right, that's about it for the programme today. Going to be back with you tomorrow for the newspaper review on YouTube at 9:30-ish. It'll be 9:30 on youtube.com/Richie Allen Show. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Thanks again to Robin. Thank you for listening. Look after yourselves and one another. Going out with some Oasis. Bit of Oasis here. Never been the biggest fan in the world, but I do like one or two tunes. I like this one. Bye for now. See you tomorrow.